This is an ABC podcast.
Afatei talohani and good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. We proudly bring our show to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. Hopefully you had a great weekend. We are back in the hot seat for your Monday morning. Well, guess what? Change in Vanuatu's constitution hopes to bring about political stability, and Ni Vanuatuans are actually high on the list of those going to jail while here in Australia. And finally, forest therapy. Have you ever heard of it? Well, it actually could help with trauma. More on these stories shortly. Once our show is done, please, if you want to find out more on our stories, type in Pacific Beat Radio Australia into your search engine and like, follow us on Facebook and Instagram via ABC Pacific. Time to see what's happening in our Pacific region. I'm Aggie Dubowa and this is Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. We start off with Vanuatu citizens residing in Australia, New Zealand and Fiji who are on track to participate in the upcoming national referendum. The referendum will be the first of its kind and aims to change the constitution to bring about political stability. The ABC's Leah Loanbu with more.
For the first time, polling stations will be set up in three countries to allow Vanuatu citizens to cast their vote during the referendum on May 29. More than 16,000 workers from Vanuatu are in Australia and New Zealand. A team from Vanuatu's electoral office are running an awareness program to help voters in these countries. Seasonal worker and team leader Eddie Mansale is in Stanthorpe and is pleased that workers will get a chance to participate in the upcoming referendum.
For me, this is 100% support, very supportive of this, so that we could give a chance to everyone, which means those who can write, those who don't know how to write, they are privileged to exercise their rights anyway.
He says in the past it was difficult for overseas voters to cast their ballot from afar.
The thing is that we've got people from in Vanuatu, we've got different islands. They actually came up from the islands, come to town in Port Vila and go to the airport, fly direct to wherever they go to in Australia. And the thing is that whenever we have an election, it's hard for them to communicate or follow the instruction to say to do a proxy. And proxies on these days are not easy. You need certain emails to be floating here and there.
Vanuatu's principal electoral officer, Gilong Maleses, says polling stations have been set up in areas in Australia where many Ni Vanuatu reside.
We identify at the moment 5 places to be considered as polling stations during the polling day. One in Cairns, the second one in Budapest, third one in Stanthorpe, fourth in Launceston, and 5 in Mildura. We are trying to accommodate all the people who are in Australia, this nearest police station, so that they can go and cast their vote physically on the 29th May.
2 areas have already been identified in New Zealand, in Te Puke, and the other in Plenum. In Fiji, 14 stations have been set up in Nandi and Suva. Mr. Maleses is advising citizens to use their national ID card to vote.
By using a national ID card, the sole instrument that will be used during the referendum, not only in Vanuatu, but also in overseas. In Australia and New Zealand and New Caledonia and Fiji.
The referendum will decide whether Vanuatu adopts changes to its constitution, seeking to end the instability that has long gripped its politics. Under the changes, MPs who leave their parties would vacate their seats. And MPs who are independent, the sole representative of their parties or from a custom movement, would also have to affiliate with a political party. In Stanthorpe, Mr. Mansale from Vanuatu says more awareness is needed for seasonal workers in Australia.
I think the awareness part of it is better off going more. We have 2 delegations, like I said, coming here to Stanthorpe and to Toowoomba. We actually got a message that is very loud and clear, And we're actually going back to our places and start sending the message out to people and letting them know how it's gonna work. But the thing is, I think we need more awareness, actually.
And that's Lea Loanbu with that report.
Pacific Beat.
Now, Australian museums and universities have been repatriating Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander human remains for over 30 years now. But what about the remains of Pacific Islanders in Australian institutions? Human remains were taken during a dark time in history when institutions collected them for racist, pseudo-scientific purposes. An investigation by the Pacific has found nearly 1,500 Pacific ancestors in 13 institutions across the country. A warning, the story contains the names and images of Pacific Island and First Nation Australian ancestors. Hugo Hodge with more.
Nikolai Miklahu McLeod Jr. is on his way to the remote Rye Coast in Papua New Guinea. Nikolai is a direct descendant of the famous Russian scientist and explorer of the same name, who first came here over 150 years ago. Nikolai studied life here, and in 1877, he left with 16 human skulls, taken with consent according to his records.
Hello, my brother!
I'm really happy I'm here.
The Russian explorer is still remembered fondly here, and his namesake's arrival is cause for celebration. We've given Nikolai information on the whereabouts of those 16 skulls, which he's about to share with the elders of Bongu and Gurendu villages.
Have you heard of some of these ancestors' name before? Andan, Ibor, Kakye, Panakye.
Panakye is from Komblum.
Panakye from Gurendu. Okay.
I am ancestor of Panakye, and Panakye is a chief warrior. He's a fighter. I never knew that the skull of my ancestor Panakye is at Sydney University in Australia.
Those 16 skulls, and many others collected by the Russian explorer, ended up at the University of Sydney in 1889 following his death. The university declined an interview for this story, but said they'd consider any requests for repatriation. The Pacific made inquiries with Australia's historic museums and universities and discovered nearly 1,500 Pacific ancestors at 13 institutions. The Australian Museum has the most, with nearly 400 ancestors, and the University of Sydney has nearly 300.
A lot of these human remains either purchased, some were traded, and there were those that were just robbed and taken illegally, looting.
Tarusi Vunidillo is a Fijian archaeologist who has worked with museums globally to repatriate ancestors. She says human remains were historically taken by pseudoscientists to justify racial inequality and estimates there could be up to 100,000 Pacific ancestral remains in institutions around the world.
A lot of international museums, they sometimes don't understand how we are so emotionally connected to these individuals. That kind of connection through spirituality, through our DNA, through our names, through our totems, it's something that continues forever.
Around the world, Western institutions have been trying to right the wrongs of the past. Australian museums have returned more than 2,700 Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander remains. By comparison, repatriations from Australia to the Pacific rarely happen. Only four of the institutions we spoke to are working on Pacific repatriations.
I think it comes back to what purpose would those human remains do for those institutions today. If there's no use, maybe scientifically or educationally, you know, for it to be taking space in the museum storage, then the right decision is for them to go back home. That's something I always encourage our museums in the Pacific, you know, not to wait for Australian museums to come to them. It could go the other way as well.
But repatriation is often costly and complex. Institutions lack resources, cultural understanding, and even details about the origin of the remains. Securing government funding for Pacifica repatriations is also a challenge. A spokesperson for the Department of the Arts said the Australian government only provides funding for the return of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander remains.
Australian institutions holding foreign ancestors are responsible for their care and decisions about their repatriation.
Dr. Vunidilu called on the Australian government to return Pacific remains with the same energy they give to the repatriation of Aboriginal remains from foreign institutions back to country.
Now there's kind of like a whole movement, you know, globally, which is exciting. And if it's happening that it's repatriation from Europe to the Pacific, then our neighbours, including New Zealand and Australia, they need to start doing the same thing as well.
Back on the Rye Coast, a heated discussion has broken out amongst the villagers.
Six of us, we have discussed and we all agree to brought back our skull to Porenduk for proper burial.
We feel very bad when we heard that our ancestors' skulls are in Sydney. As the Christian country, we want to get the skulls of our ancestors and bury them.
Following the ABC's inquiries, the University of Sydney said it had received a repatriation request from the Rye Coast. In a twist of fate, Nikolai Jr. finds himself in a similar situation. After his burial, Nikolai Sr.'s skull was exhumed and it ended up in a St. Petersburg museum.
I believe that his skull has served the good science and humanity, and it is time to put it in the ground, to bury it.
And that is Nikolai McLuhu McClay Jr. ending that report from Hugo Hodge.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Yeah, welcome back to Pacific Beat. I'm your host, Aggie Dubol. While Pacific Island countries are moving to gain control over the labour drains hitting employers after the explosion in seasonal worker numbers since COVID, Vanuatu has trialled a new visa, trying to bring in more workers from overseas, but early results have been disappointing for businesses. Meanwhile, experts say it's too early to say whether Samoa and Tonga will succeed in their plans to better control which workers join labour mobility schemes. Doug Dingwall with this report.
For Maurice Masuino, recruiting a new electrician will mean an international search for candidates.
We've got two large projects, probably 12 months' work, that are starting fairly soon. I'll probably apply for it again because, as I see now, there's only two A-grade electricians in our company. And so it puts a lot of pressure on me and also the other electricians. So we need to get a couple of electricians in here.
His Vanuatu business, South Pacific Electrics, lost 10% of its staff to seasonal work in Australia and New Zealand, and electricians are in short supply at home. It's one of many trades and occupations facing shortages as thousands of Ni Vanuatu leave for popular labour mobility schemes.
The reality, we do advertise positions. There is hardly no one replying to it, and the people replying to those positions may not have the qualifications or may require a lot of trainings to have them up to that standard.
That's Vanuatu Chamber of Commerce and Industry President Antoine Bordier, who's calling for urgent fixes to the labour shortages. Vanuatu is looking abroad for a solution, creating an emergency visa to bring in 1,500 foreign workers. But early results are disappointing. After 1 year, only 200 people have applied. One problem is the visa only lasts 12 months and cannot be renewed or extended, making it less appealing for foreign workers considering a move to Vanuatu.
So it has created a little dilemma at that level. The fact that a lot of people did apply, 160 of them did apply for them, and today they're all coming to the situation that they need to renew those visas.
Mr. Masuino hired an electrician from Australia using the emergency visa and says it offered him a solution even with its flaws and delays.
Firstly, we've got to try and get the person. We've got to interview him and whatever. Secondly, we've got to make sure that he's got a police clearance. Then we have to organise with the government here his permits and so forth. Even though they are a fast permit, we've still got to go through all the paperwork and so forth. And then we have to wait for them to approve it.
But the Chamber of Commerce says the emergency visa program is now on hold as it waits to speak to the government about a review. Pacific Island nations have been reviewing their labour mobility policies since an explosion in the number of workers joining the schemes after the COVID-19 pandemic. And in another post-pandemic change, some say that Pacific Island governments are more willing now to voice their concerns. Kirsty Petru, a Griffith University expert in labour mobility schemes.
Before COVID, Pacific Island country governments were often quite reluctant to speak out if they thought things weren't working for them. As numbers have increased, they're much more willing to speak out and say, hang on, we need to look at this issue. We're experiencing this problem. Let's talk about it and see what kind of solution we can come up with.
One of their concerns is that the scheme started as a way for unemployed or unskilled people to find work. But now they employ more skilled people who already have jobs. And in Tonga and Samoa, there are plans to bring more rural workers and unemployed people back into the schemes. But Dr. Petru says it's still too early to know how successful they'll be in solving labour shortages.
The issue is that sometimes governments, and particularly the labour sending units that handle labour mobility schemes, are often so pressed for time. You know, they're trying to process literally thousands of visas for people. They don't always have time to implement those longer term kind of strategies, higher level goals.
A New Zealand Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Trade spokesperson says they're providing more support to Pacific countries to better determine who's eligible to join its labour mobility scheme. Australia's Pacific Minister Pat Conroy said the government was supporting skills development in countries participating in the scheme to help them fill labour market gaps.
And that's Doug Dingwall reporting. Stay tuned, because up shortly it is your news wrap with producer Mackenzie Smith.
Newsroom Footy, hosted by me, Sam Wykes,
and me, Tenero Aruna. Each week we'll bring you Pacific Islander stories from on and off the rugby league and rugby union field.
We'll have plenty of special guests, tales from the past, tackle the big topics of today, and look forward to the next gen Newsroom Footy stars.
Newsroom Footy. Newsroom Footy.
Monday afternoons at 4 o'clock PNG time.
On ABC Radio Australia.
Hold the front page!
Kia ora and welcome back to Pacific Beat. It is that time where we head around the region to get the latest in headlines. And that is our news wrap brought to you by producer Mackenzie Smith. With that, I say morena, Mackenzie.
Morning, Aggie.
Thank you so much for joining us this morning. Well, let's get into it. I mean, the opposition parties in Solomon Islands, it looks like they've struck a coalition agreement as they try to form a government.
Yeah, so right now, no party has the votes that they need to form a government in Solomon Islands, but the opposition Care Coalition, alongside Peter Kenny Laurier Jr.'s Solomon Islands United Party, were able to sign a pact on Sunday. And in a statement reported by local media, they appealed to other independent MPs to join their bloc and take back Solomon Islands. The former Prime Minister, Rick Ho, who is part of that coalition, told Reuters that no decision had yet been made about who they're going to put forward for a Prime Minister candidate.
Yeah, we'll definitely hopefully try and bring something to that story as we wait and see who the new government will be. We head to the UN human rights, a human rights expert who has actually spoken out against the Kiribati Parliament's decision to deport an Australian High Court judge. What have they said?
Yeah, so that High Court judge is David Lambourne. He was first suspended from office 2 years ago on allegations of misconduct, which sparked a judicial crisis in Kiribati. Lambourne's been fighting a long-running legal battle ever since to block his suspension. But on Friday, Parliament in Kiribati voted in favour of a resolution that would advise President Taunes Mamau to remove Lambourne from the High Court. Since then, the UN Special Rapporteur on the Independence of Judges and Lawyers, Margaret Satterthwaite, released a statement saying the decision is a major setback for justice and rule of law in the country. She's urging the government to take all measures to ensure the independence of the judiciary and the tenure of judges, including by granting Lambourne a visa while he awaits an appeal.
Finally, it was the Super Rugby Women's Champions Grand Final over the weekend. Who took it out?
Yeah, well, much to the disappointment of Fijians, it was the New South Wales Waratahs who came away with the win yesterday, beating Fijian Drua 50-14 at Ballymore Stadium. A few tries close to halftime put the Drua within 3 points of the Waratahs, but the New South Wales side were able to take it out as they bagged 3 tries in just 7 minutes.
But well done again to the women's team, Fijiana Drua. Mackenzie, thank you so much for bringing our news wrap this morning.
No worries.
Now, a recent visit to Australia from Vanuatu's Minister of Internal Affairs, Johnny Koanapo, has revealed that many Ni Vanuatu citizens are ending up in prisons due to a variety of minor to very serious offences. Mr Koanapo visited the seasonal workers who are part of the Pacific Australia Labour Mobility Program, or PALM scheme, and said the exact numbers of those in prison is still unclear, but wants to see better measures put in when briefing the workers before they depart to Australia. Our reporter Caroline Tierman spoke with Mr Koanapo.
It's a bilateral discussion that my ministry is responsible for the workers, the labour mobility, and my ministry is also responsible for referendum. And because we're having referendum for the first time, and we will be having polling stations in Australia for the first time, and this is why I had to personally engage with the government of Australia to inform them, but at the same time to seek their assistance in establishing polling stations in several states in Australia. Besides the discussions on labour mobility issues, as well as other issues that are of interest to both countries.
Since you returned from Australia to Vanuatu, you raised the issue of many Ni Vanuatu who are in prisons in Australia. Could you tell us more about this?
Well, I think what my point is that this is a fact that cannot be denied in terms of the numbers of Ni Vanuatu who happen to find themselves in prisons in Australia in certain states. So I was just raising a point that the level of understanding and knowledge of our citizens on particular offences and on things which might not be considered as offences here in Vanuatu, or the way the law is being enforced, probably a bit different from the way it is being done in Australia in terms of the enforcement. So perhaps it is a shock to a lot of our people who find themselves in different situations in Australia. So my point is, this is something that we as a government, we need to be able to address, especially in relation to the pre-departure briefings of our people. I also intend to engage one or two lawyers to be part of pre-departure briefings before our people go to Australia to engage themselves in the seasonal work. The briefings must be comprehensive in a way that it also covers certain issues that our people need to be aware of before they get into the plane to Australia. People perhaps take certain things for granted, and then the situation is not the same in Australia. So my point is, while we already have pre-departure briefings in Vanuatu, but I believe it is more important to include some legal briefings on certain issues, particularly with the way they conduct themselves in Australia. It must be an important element in the briefing, because then it helps to keep them away from trouble.
Minister, you also mentioned that some of the Ni Vanuatu have also been imprisoned because of rape, and rape is bad or is wrong in any country. So how many of these workers are in jail, do you think?
The information is not very clear to me, but I was given information by just one person, and I need to ascertain the information. But I do understand, having obtained some reliable information, that quite a number of them are in jail. I'm not able to say how many, because the system is not directly connected to the ministry information, especially from Labour. So that's something that we have to work on. And then I think, you know, the way the governance structure of the program needs to be reviewed, so we can at least know how many people are living in Vanuatu, how many people are currently in Australia, how many people are finding themselves in different kinds of situations. The government need to have this information.
In the past, Ni Vanuatu or other workers from the Pacific often raise concerns about the working conditions in the horticulture industry. Could that be one of the reasons that causes some of these workers to go off the rails, so to speak?
I do not want to believe that the conditions in the farm are the pushing factor that is compelling them to commit certain offences. I think that that's a matter of personal choice for the people, but I believe it is important to be fair in our argument to say that the way the welfare situation of our people is something that all of us have discussed, and I've listened to them. I've listened to them along with the High Commissioner of Australia and the officials from BFAT, who have also accompanied me to certain states. We've listened to some of the concerns of our workers, and we are discussing that with the Government of Australia. I'm happy to say that the Government of Australia is very open to discussing these issues, and it's in our interest to find a solution that is a win-win situation for all of us. And I think that the Australian government, as far as I'm concerned, according to our discussions, they're very open to discuss and finding ways in how to better address the situations of our workers, particularly when it comes to their welfare.
You are back in Port Vila. Have you spoken with the other stakeholders on this issue, maybe to have a look at some changes?
The policy prerogative is a matter for government, and we're working on that. We're working very closely with the Chamber of Commerce and others as well, and I'm having some more discussions on this. I continue to have it as a priority that the government must deal with, because we're not talking about hundreds, we're talking about thousands of our citizens who are involved in the program. So it's an immediate priority that the government must really look towards finding some solutions to it.
Overall, Minister, you and the people of Vanuatu are happy with these schemes in Australia and New Zealand?
Yes, I mean, it's an opportunity, and we're happy about it. And then, as I mentioned to a number of ministers in Australia that I met a couple of weeks ago, that these kinds of engagement is not new, because our forefathers had been at one time taken to Australia, perhaps not under such arrangements, but under difficult arrangements at that time, and they were taken during blackbirding to work in Australia. And so they've made immense contributions to the foundations of horticulture and then agriculture to some extent, and one or two other industries that our forefathers, not only Vanuatu, but Papua New Guinea as well, the Fiji, Solomon Islands, as well as other Pacific Island countries, that our people have helped to lay the foundations of some of these sectors in Australia.
And that's Vanuatu's Minister of Internal Affairs, Johnny Koanapo, ending that report with Caroline Terriman.
Tune in to SBS Samoa News on ABC Radio Australia. SBS Samoa News features independent news and stories connecting you to life in Australia and Samoan-speaking Australians by our friends at SBS Australia. SBS Samoa News. Tune in Mondays and Thursdays at 6:05 a.m. Samoan time for 1 hour of news in the Samoan language on ABC Radio Australia.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. The story, well, it probably touches the soul too sometimes. After bushfires tore through the Hawaiian island of Maui, forest therapy walks have helped locals re-establish a sense of place, and it's becoming increasingly popular around the world, with scientists studying its health benefits. Guides say the practice has untapped therapeutic and economic potential for Australians dealing with trauma.
Every day on his morning walk, Phil Stubbs stands still for at least 10 minutes and listens to nothing. Since he started giving himself permission to move slower, he notices all sorts of things in the silence. He notices the thud of a grey kangaroo bouncing, the fairy wren darting across the path, or the common blue-tailed dragonfly zipping through the air that he says tastes like eucalyptus. The resident from Congo on the New South Wales far south coast is practicing forest therapy.
We need nature to feel whole and human.
Mr. Stubbs remembers working 50 hours per week and looking out from his desk in a Sydney office building and seeing hundreds of humans hunched over computers in little glass-windowed boxes.
A lot of people spend a lot of their lives on computers, and I don't think we as human beings are evolved to do it.
Searching for ways to escape technology and reconnect with nature led Mr. Stubbs to forest therapy. He is so convinced of the benefits of the practice, he became one of 62 certified Association of Nature and Forest Therapy guides in Australia. Mr. Stubbs took me on one of the tours he started running in the Yurrabadalla Botanic Gardens, an area burnt during the Black Summer bushfires. Pulling off the Princes Highway and turning off the car's engine, you enter a little natural haven.
Soon I'll get you to close your eyes, but before I do, what I'd like you to do is just have a really good look around you and just notice where we are today. Normally when you go for a walk, you don't do that. Often you're going from A to B. And really, this is about really taking in the atmosphere of the forest.
Mr. Stubbs says forest bathing is like coming home to yourself.
I think when you slow down and you start using your senses, you stop worrying about all the things that you've got to do and stuff coming up in the past, and you're just in the present moment. It's almost like it's given me license to just stop and notice things and think, yeah, I'm going to spend some time with this and just notice. Like stand on the beach and notice the sun come up and listen to the waves and close my eyes and just really enjoy it. A couple of days ago, I ran into our neighbour who'd been away for a while. And I hadn't seen him for a while, and he said, "Phil, you look healthy." And so he said, "What have you been doing?" And this is one of the key things that I've been doing.
He sees economic potential in forest therapy to help people heal, de-stress or reconnect with nature. Association of Nature and Forest Therapy Director Jackie Quang says forest therapy could be used at corporate events, for rehabilitation at nursing homes or as an ecotourism attraction.
There's great potential and we've probably only scratched the surface, but on the mental health front, there's a lot of potential there.
She says there is scientific research showing the practice reduces blood pressure and heart rate, increases brain oxygen levels, decreases production of the stress hormone cortisol, and leads to healthier sleep patterns.
Intuitively, we know that nature is good for us.
And there is growing interest in using the practice to help people reconnect with landscapes that have been ravaged by climate-related disasters. Phyllis Look has been leading therapy walks in the forests of Hawaii for 5 years. But her work took on a new purpose after Maui was devastated by wildfires last year.
There's like now this place in your homeland that has been, that you've always known was there, and now this place is no longer. Forest bathing is really good about establishing or re-establishing this connection to place and your connection to your identity, to who you are.
She is using forest therapy to help Hawaiian bushfire survivors and firefighters deal with their trauma. Before a recent session, one bushfire survivor told Miss Look she felt dead inside.
By the end of it, she said, "Nature has the answers. I may not know all the stuff that I need to right now, but nature has the answers. And she felt more alive again. She had like remembered that she wasn't just this dry husk of a person. So when you see that little green shoot that's coming out of the burnt tree, it tells you, hey, maybe that's also me. Maybe I too have a part of me that was destroyed, but that also there's a part of me that is emerging forth, and that it's not all dead and death and destruction. So I think that's one of the ways that we can think about how something that was dangerous can also eventually become a friend and helpful to us. Whether it's fires and floods, wars, pandemics, we need to be able to find a way to take care of ourselves.
And that is founder of Forest Bathing Hawaii, Phyllis Look, ending that story by James Tugwell. There's a new book titled My Land, My Life, and it's been launched recently at the University of Hawaii at the Cultural Centre in Vanuatu, looking at the leasing of lots of customary land to foreigners in the early 2000s. Pacific Islanders as well as Indigenous Australians view land as their blood and mother, a representation of their identity and culture to help sustain their livelihoods. But without land, Indigenous people in the Pacific often feel powerless and dispossessed, homeless and losing their identity. Written by lawyer and associate professor at the Australian National University Crawford School of Public Policy, Dr. Siobhan McDonnell, she recently spoke with Caroline Turman.
The book is basically the story of the land rush that happened in Vanuatu between 2000 and 2014, and in that time over 10% of customary land was leased. So particularly on Afate and Santo, Afate is the main island in Vanuatu, now 56.5% of the coastline is gone, which is the best land in terms of farming and really necessary for access to the salt water and fishing. So what the book describes is, what are those processes of dispossession? What do they actually look like? And how does that link with property law? And the book goes very deep. It's a really detailed legal and ethnographic account of what was happening in Vanuatu at the time. And the reason that it's written like that is to remind everybody about the scale of the land rush that was taking place, but also to explain why we created the land reform package and the constitutional changes in 2014 when I was the principal drafter of those new laws, what they were in response to.
Since that reform, have things changed with regard to the land?
Yeah, things have changed a lot. So people are no longer worried that customary land is going to be leased out from underneath them without their consent in the way that was happening before the land reform package. So before the land reform package came in, the Minister of Lands had a lot of powers that were built under the Constitution and then came into pieces of legislation. What the land reform package did was strip away those powers from Ministers of Land, because we knew that successive Ministers of Land had been abusing their powers and leasing land without the consent of the customary group. So in 2004, for example, one minister signed 250 leases over customary land in 1 year. So this was a big source of illicit payments. It was a big source of corruption in government in Vanuatu. But then the other part of the story is powerful men or chiefs, people who I term the masters of modernity in my book, were also leasing the land that properly belonged to other people. So those problems have been fixed in the land reform package. That does not mean that everything's perfect. There are other problems that have cropped up, but it is better than it was before.
How long were those leases for?
In Vanuatu, like many other parts of the Pacific, the lease term is 75 years, which is the life of the coconut tree. So it came at the time of colonial government putting in leases for coconut plantations, and that history has endured. So all these leases that I'm talking about over customary land are for 75 years, at least, even though the Constitution says land is held by custom landowners, by Indigenous people, in practice, there is really large-scale leasing now across Vanuatu, and people are living on that land who are not Indigenous people. So a lot of subdivisions, a lot of tourism resorts across the Fate, but in other, on many other islands as well.
I heard some time back that the people who are leasing the land actually don't allow people to even walk near those pieces of land to go to the beach.
That's right. So if you drive around the Fate's coastline now, and you can do that because there's a ring road that goes around the island, what you will see are a lot of gated communities and a lot of gated residences that are mainly owned by people who are not Ni Vanuatu. And what that does, these huge gates or these huge walls that are built around, mean that people can no longer access beaches, they can no longer access the coastline, they can no longer fish, they can no longer swim. But also that coastal land is the most arable land. It's the best place for people to make gardens. So across the Fate now, there's not nearly as much land on the coastal area as there was before, but also there's a lot of large inland leases too. So, you know, there's a real issue now about where people will continue to live in the future and how they get access to land going forward, local people.
When you speak to some of these Indigenous landowners, what are they thinking now?
So it depends, right? People have a lot of different ideas about what they want to do. Some people are still interested in leasing their land. Some people don't want to lease their land. Land in Vanuatu, like everywhere else in the Pacific, people here say, my land, my life. You know, land is the mother. It's the place that you eat out of, that you build houses on, that you live on. So to lose land makes you much more vulnerable to some of the issues that are happening now across the Pacific. For example, if you don't have a garden, your own garden, then you're dependent on going to the store to buy food. And that's a big problem for a lot of people now living in urban villa. There's a lot of food security issues increasingly. So these are all problems that come from not having access to land. And Indigenous landowners, some of them want development, some of them don't want development. You know, there's a lot of different thinking. But the important question is there a good process to follow if you want to lease? Are people being notified? Is the whole landowning group consenting? These are all the big questions that we built into the land reform package in 2014.
Your book was firstly launched in Hawaii before you went to Port Vila to launch it. What was that like in Hawaii?
I launched the book in Hawaii because it's a University of Hawaii press book, and then I came to Vanuatu. But in Hawaii, the audience was full of people who were Kanaka Maoli, native Hawaiians, and people from Aotearoa, from New Zealand, who also feel the pain of this process of dispossession, right? So this is a story that is very much about Vanuatu, but it has echoes in lots of other parts of the Pacific and more broadly. So we know, for example, there's been the SABL leasing in Papua New Guinea, that's been a massive set of leasing instruments over there. We know that there are these kinds of pressures that happen all across the Pacific. And it's partly because foreigners want their patch of paradise. So that's why the subtitle of my book is called Dispossession at the Frontier of Desire, because often foreigners are imposing their own ideas onto the landscape, and that's what makes them want to buy it. And these are really big issues for many of the countries in the region to think about.
And that's Dr. Siobhan McDonald ending that report with Caroline Tiraman. And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. It's time to take a look back at one of our main stories today. Vanuatu citizens residing in Australia, New Zealand and Fiji are on track to participate in the upcoming national referendum, including seasonal worker Eddie Mansale.
We actually got a message that is very loud and clear, and we're actually going back to our places and start sending the message out to people and letting them know how it's gonna work.
Now, you can find our top stories on our website. Just type Pacific Beat and Radio Australia into your search engine. And you can hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. But remember, we'll be back at the same time tomorrow at 6 a.m. PNG time. Stay tuned to ABC Radio Australia, though, because news is next. And then coming up after that, it's Nisha Daily. Until next time, Otua Ofato. I'm Aggie Thubol, and you've been tuning into Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific.